Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Israeli Ambassador Asher Naim. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's the last couple of days of the secular year 2013, which means we are inundated with the best of and worst of lists everywhere right now. While it seems morally wrong to say Lishana Tova right now, it's not a Jewish New Year after all, I'm still reminded of John Stewart's famous comment about New Year's. He says he likes to go to Times Square on Rosh Hashanah, since it's much less crowded than it is on December 31st. In fact, it's just a few Jewish guys walking around going, "What's up?" While some Jewish best of lists come out around Rosh Hashanah, there are always a few that pop up in late December, and 2013 is proving to be no exception. In fact, maybe there's more best of lists now. The Forward newspaper, one of the best representatives of Jewish journalism today, has a top 13 Jewish stories for 2013. Get it? While the NJOP, formerly the National Jewish Outreach Program, run by past two Jewish guests, Rabbi Ephraim Buchwald, has a top 18 viral Jewish stories of 2013, and the ADL, headed by past two Jewish guest Abe Foxman, released its list of top 10 Jewish issues of 2013. I suspect there will be many, many other lists of top Jewish news items from the past 12 months. And like all Jewish efforts in every area, the lists, of course, don't agree with one another. Well, I'm not sure if 13 or 18 are better, more Jewish numbers to collect over the course of a year, but 10 worked for the commandments, so it's good enough for me. And in looking back over the arbitrary measure of time we use to mark the secular year, we here at Two Jewish certainly believe that this is a time when it's appropriate to decide what the top 10 Jewish stories of 2013 were from our perspective, which is, of course, the right one. So, here we go, our top 10 Jewish stories of 2013.
Lately, I've been losing sleep, dreaming about the things that we could be. But baby, I've been praying hard, said no more counting dollars, we'll be counting stars. Yeah, we'll be counting stars.
Story number 10. In America, Jews continue to thrive in high places. Jack Lew, the new Secretary of the Treasury, is an observant Orthodox Jew. Janet Yellen, the new head of the Federal Reserve Board, is the first woman to head the Fed, and of course, the first Jewish woman. Both positions have been held by Jews before, with the Fed's last three chairs covering over 25 years, all Jewish. Story number 9. Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu and U.S. President Barack Obama clearly don't like each other much, and they sparred on and off over the course of the year. And with U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry's brokered peace talks between Israelis and Palestinians struggling along, the pressure on Netanyahu has mounted. How will it all end? We'll find out in 2014, or perhaps after that. Story number 8. A ridiculously opulent bar mitzvah video by a kid named Sam Horowitz, a 13-year-old boy who can really dance, went completely viral on the web, raising questions about just what coming of age for an American Jewish teen means today, and how much effort and money should be dedicated to the absurdity of self-promotion. Story number 7. Yeshiva University's sexual abuse of students scandal continues to evolve, going back many years and extending to many victims, some of them famous today. The furor has not subsided, and the fallout for the most prestigious modern Orthodox institution in America continues to be significant. Story number six, Thanksgiving and Hanukkah coincided for the very first time, which won't happen again for 79,000 years or so, giving rise to a host of Thanksgivica t-shirts that were worn once and will never be worn again.
As she stood in the doorway, I have a mission bound. I know I'm thinking to myself, this could be heaven, this could be hell. Then she lit up the candle, and she showed me the way. There were voices down the corridor, I thought I heard them say, welcome to the Hotel California. Such a lovely place, such a lovely place, such a lovely face.
Story number five, the Gatt brothers, Arye and Gil Gatt, two ultra-Orthodox singer-guitarists from the Breslover Hasidic sect, wearing long black coats, yarmulkes, and payas, are the stars of an Israeli reality TV show, Rising Star, Kochav Haba, performing songs by Pink Floyd, Simon & Garfunkel, and the Eagles. You haven't lived until you've seen these guys singing Hotel California in mildly accented English, but with great guitar work on YouTube. Story number four, a huge cache of Jewish-owned art stolen by the Nazis was discovered in Munich, and it reopened the continuing scandal of masterpieces never having been restored to the heirs of its original Jewish owners. Story number three, would Iran be allowed to go nuclear? And would a change in leadership to a less insanely anti-Semitic guy lead to an Iran deal that would force them to stop working on nuclear devices? Nuclear fears continue, but a temporary deal is now in place. We'll find out in 2014 just how successful it is. Story number two, in Israel, the women of the wall continued to try to pray peacefully at the Kotel, and in their 25th anniversary year, the hostility of the ultra-Orthodox and the support for the women of the wall from all around the world finally pushed the Israeli government to work on a permanent solution, giving them access to the wall for truly egalitarian Jewish prayer. And finally, the number one story of 2013. The Pew Report showed we have more Jews than we thought here in America by more than a million. But those Jews also seem less religious, more likely to consider themselves Jewish by culture more than anything else. What will it mean for the future of Judaism in this golden diaspora? Only we here on Too Jewish truly know. And we can't tell you until the next secular year rolls around. And that was the top 10 Jewish stories from 2013, which means it's nearly time for 2014 with even better Jewish stories to come. Before we get to that next year, one more great Too Jewish show for you this 2013 year. Our guest, Ambassador Asher Naim, has had an amazing career as a diplomatic representative of Israel, ranging from his birth in North Africa to Israel to the cold of Russia to the heat of Ethiopia. And he was in the middle of some of the most remarkable tales of liberation and rescue in all of Jewish history. Find out all about them and get the inside story when we return here on Too Jewish. Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, a very special guest this morning. He's Ambassador Asher Naim. He had a remarkable diplomatic career, which included serving as the ambassador of Israel to Ethiopia during the period of Operation Solomon, in which he was instrumental. But that's only a part of his long service to Israel. He also was ambassador to Finland and negotiated the passage of Russian Jews at the time of long before Perestroika, when Jews couldn't get out of Russia, and he helped to make that possible. He served as ambassador in Kenya and Uganda and laid the foundation for Israel's diplomatic relations in sub-Saharan Africa and many other services to Israel. Boker Tov, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, sir.
So I have to ask, you're originally from Tripoli.
Right.
And came to Israel. What was it like to be a Libyan Jew in Israel at a time when it wasn't so easy for Libyan Jews to ascend in the hierarchy?
No. As a matter of fact, wasn't at all. I felt at home. I was, the Jewish community of Tripoli was a very Zionist group. And I, for one, I went to school, three schools a day. In the morning, Italian school. As you know, Italy was the
colonial control of Libya.
Yeah, from 1911 till 1945. So, and then in the afternoon, I went to the rabbi like you, and he told me what is Parashat HaShavua and Bible and all the history of the Jews. And in the evening, I went to the Zionist school, to Hebrew school. The Hebrew school where we learned about Eretz Israel, about the kibbutz, about the Hebrew language as used every day, not only prayer, but use it every day.
As a living language.
Living language.
When you first came to Israel, you eventually you fought in the War of Independence, which makes you part of Israel's history if you'd done nothing else, and then went on and went to Hebrew University, the premier university in Israel. Tell me about your service in the War of Independence.
I want to start, if I may, how did we get to Israel?
Oh, yeah, how did you get to Israel?
Yeah, because following the Second World War, all the area, the Middle East, was under the British.
Right.
So we took a truck and we put on top of it the necessary things and we start to drive.
Across North Africa?
Yeah. From Tripoli to Benghazi, from Benghazi to Massa Matruk, Massa Matruk to Alexandria, and then we took a train via Israel, Gaza, to Haifa.
Oh my gosh.
And when I got here in Israel, they saw that my Hebrew was fluent. He said, hey, you are not a new immigrant. You can join the youth, Israel, Eretz Israel youth, in a kibbutz. And I was lucky. I went to a kibbutz, the Eliyahu, Yekes.
German Jews.
And we spent the most beautiful 2 years of my life. It was in the kibbutz. It is fantastic life. You work half a day, and you study half a day. And the evening, we had lectures. We were 32 students. They come from all over the country. And, you know, being free without parents, without mother, tell you what you are not allowed or not
to
allowed
do,
to do.
Right.
That's fantastic. And then I went to Israel, to Tel Aviv, because my father died, was sick, and I had to work. And I was working in the Binyan construction.
Doing building.
Building. What do you call this building that I do? tear.
Plastering, right.
And I was AA1. That means the best...
the best plasterer in Israel. Great preparation for an illustrious diplomatic career. Yeah. We will talk much more with Ambassador Asher Naim, find out about Operation Solomon and the Ethiopian Jews, what it was like to be the first Israeli ambassador to Korea, and many other things when we return on To Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke International, new sponsors here on To Jewish. What is Freedom Smoke International?
Thank you, Rabbi Kohan. Freedom Smoke USA is an electronic cigarette company based right here out of Tucson. We were the first store in the United States, the first store to have all FDA-approved products. It's a healthier alternative to cigarette smoking.
No smoke, no tobacco, and doctors refer people to you.
That's correct. My doctor actually just gave me a glowing report from other patients he's had that I've been able to find this as a healthier alternative to smoking.
Cardiologists, pulmonologists, even dentists, huh?
That's correct. It does help with all that.
How many flavors can people get of this?
We have over 700 flavors available.
Where are the locations and how do people get connected?
Our first location is at River and Orange Grove. We opened one at Broadway and Swan, and we currently just had our grand opening at 12th and Valencia.
And we do have a store in Southern Michigan also.
And what phone number can people call?
You can call the toll-free number at 1-800-705-7013. That's freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thank you, and we'll talk some more next week. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at tojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at tojewishradio.com. You can also email us at our new email, tojewishradio18@gmail.com. Hear all past and present shows by streaming them from our website, tojewishradio.com, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our Mivina in Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So I don't want to say Lishana Tova, because this isn't Rosh Hashanah, but it is getting close to the new year. And although Israelis celebrate primarily Jewish holidays, there's this one holiday they really do celebrate, only they don't always call it New Year's. They call it Sylvester. Mm-hmm. Can you explain?
It's a funny question because some of us really arguing, do you really know who was Sylvester?
Me personally, he was a cat in a cartoon.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So, but anyway, since we are in Israel, we are managing our daily life by the Gregorian calendar. So, sometimes it was 1 year. It was a very big deal. It was the millennium,
right?
And
year
we celebrate, and right. We celebrated, but we also was very afraid of the bugs of the computers and the
right. So remember, the world was going to end because all the computers were going to crash.
But we're celebrating. The young people will go outside, will drink, and it's a kind of a big deal. It's one of the only happy event in the middle of December, the dark December, the dark winter. So
it's another excuse.
It's not a religion holiday, so we are feeling very comfortable to celebrate it.
Is it celebrated more in Tel Aviv than in Jerusalem, do you think? I mean, is it more among the Chilonim?
Of course, yeah. And I said it's not a religious, of course it's a religious, not for us.
Right.
It's a religious.
Right. Well, I don't know if New Year's is really even thought of as a religious holiday. I know it's Jesus's bris, if you follow it, his brit milah, but I don't think most Christians think about it that way, personally. Is it a big deal if you don't have a date for New Year's in Israel like it is in America?
No. No, it's not. But it's a nice day to celebrate, that's it. But I guess it's become less and less.
So it's actually diminishing in
practice. Yeah, it's diminishing. When I'm getting older. I don't know. It's one of these or both of them.
It might be a young people's celebratory holiday. Uh-huh. Well, it sounds like a nice way to celebrate something that isn't so important. Mm-hmm. Are there other secular holidays like New Year's that are celebrated by Israelis, really?
Secular?
Yes.
You can consider like May 1st as a secular in Israel.
May Day.
May 1st in Israel, you can consider it as a secular holiday because it's the Poalim, Chag HaPoalim.
The holiday of the workers, socially, the labor holiday, right?
Yeah.
And that goes back to its sort of communist, socialist foundations of the state of Israel. Well, you don't have to worry about that on December 31st
and
January 1st.
Yeah, we have time until May.
But we will talk
next year.
Secular year. All right, L'Shana Tova. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your tax dollars to JETCO, J-E-T-C-O, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. The state of Arizona allows its taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations, who then provide scholarships for kids from kindergarten through 12th grade to attend qualified private schools. JETCO helps provide a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get a 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Tax credit's not a deduction. Your taxes are reduced by the amount you give. Join over 750 supporters last year who donated money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income taxes. There's an additional tax credit now, the switcher credit, which increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,031 for single filers, $2,062 for married couples filing jointly. When we are fighting every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, we should all take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to help foster a Jewish identity for our community's children. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive the financial aid they need to receive a good Jewish education. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, call 520-647-8442, again 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Help give the gift of education. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about the connections between international drug trade and international terrorism, the developing world, and began to move towards the Middle East. Let's keep going on that.
Right. Okay. One of the things that I want to do first, sort of just to clear the playing field from a certain misconception, is ever since 9/11, in our country, at least, in our public discourse, we tend to link the words Islamic or Muslim fundamentalist or whatever with terrorism. And we forget about all the other terrorist groups which over the past 30 or 40 years have taken lives and wreaked havoc, and some of which have absolutely nothing to do with Islam. But may nonetheless have something to do with the international drug trade. And I want to just enumerate a few of those to remind your listeners that not every terrorist group or every terrorist individual is connected in any way, shape, or form with Islam. So we have, for example, the ASALA, which is the Armenian Liberation Army, and their agenda was largely attacking Turkish diplomatic establishments, Turkish airline establishments, Turkish airliners, et cetera, to exact retribution for what they see as the Turkish genocide of Armenian subjects of the Ottoman Empire in the early part of the 20th century.
Yeah, almost a century ago now.
Right. But that claimed a lot of lives and is still deemed by the Turks to be a potential threat, as are certain extremist aspects of the Kurdish National Liberation Movement operating in eastern and southeastern Turkey in particular. Certainly not to say that all Kurds are terrorists, but there are some who are. And that's Muslims versus Muslims. Right. That's not, and the Armenians are, of course, Christians acting against Turks who may be Muslims or Christians or Jews, whatever. But then there are clearly Christian terrorist groups like the Black Septembrists in Greece or the Basque separatists in Spain, who, and even Corsican terrorists who want autonomy from France. I mean, these are all groups which at some point in our lifetimes have represented significant threats and have claimed lives and have caused major deployments of security and intelligence personnel to protect against their aims. Now, their links with drugs are not always as clear as the Taliban's links, but one of the ways in which terrorist groups who are heavily armed and who live outside the law can most easily finance their activities is with untraceable money earned or gained or gotten somehow through the drug trade. And if we look at the Mexican cartels, I mean, they certainly terrorize Mexican citizens, if not also American travelers in Mexico. Their primary objective isn't terrorism. It's making money. But one of their tools is terrorism so that people don't cross them. And they stake out their turf and they claim monopolies in certain areas. And incidentally, they terrorize. All right, so next week we'll get to specifically Islamic terrorism and the connection in the Middle East between the international drug trade and terrorist groups.
It's a fascinating set of connections. We will talk next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. A young Jewish man excitedly tells his mother he's fallen in love and he's going to get married. He says, "Just for fun, Ma, I'm going to bring over three women. You try to guess the one I'm going to marry." So his mom agrees. The next day, he brings three beautiful women into the house and sits them down on the couch next to each other, and they chat with his mom for a while. He then says, "Okay, Ma, guess which one I'm going to marry." She immediately replies, "The redhead in the middle." "That's amazing, Ma. You're right," he says. "How did you know?" "Her, I don't like." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, a special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Bo features the real Exodus from Egypt. The climactic text is familiar from satyrs and movies, but it is no less dramatic for that familiarity. Moses and Aaron warn Pharaoh that the final plague is coming. God tells the Israelites to sacrifice a lamb and put its blood on the doorposts to protect themselves from the coming calamity. At midnight, the angel of death visits the homes of every Egyptian, from the Pharaoh on his throne to the prisoner in the dungeon, and the firstborn male son of every household dies. Even the livestock lose their firstborn males. And after long refusing freedom to the Israelites, after 10 plagues and every underhanded manipulation he could invent, Pharaoh finally gives up. He literally throws the Israelites out of Egypt, saying, "Go away from my people." There is an ironic twist to the end of this freedom narrative in Bo. Even before the Pharaoh's fruitless quest to recapture the Israelites at the sea ends badly for the Egyptians in next week's portion of B'Shalach, It comes after Pharaoh has already ordered Moses and Aaron to leave his land, but before they can go. "Be gone," Pharaoh says. And then, "But bless me first." It's a very strange thing to say to your enemy, to whom you are now essentially surrendering, "Get out, but before you go, give me a blessing." There is pathos inherent in this request, for Pharaoh has been an arrogant and magnificently stubborn opponent. Moses' request has been for religious freedom for the Israelite slaves, just 3 days to worship God, on their own, in their own Hebrew way. Rejecting this simple plea, Pharaoh has instead multiplied the slaves' work and reduced their supplies, increased their misery in the time-honored tradition of every tyrant in history. And now his combination of arrogance and egotism has brought death to his country and even his family. Pharaoh's own eldest son, his designated successor, has just died. "And now," Pharaoh says to his antagonists, Moses and Aaron, "bless me too." Interestingly, the Torah does not record Moses' response to this strange request. Did he offer a prayer for Pharaoh? What is the suitable blessing for a brutal, genocidal God-king? Was it a mourning prayer for his dead son? Or was it more like the rabbi and fiddler on the roof? "May God bless and keep the Pharaoh far away from us." Finally, after 9 plagues worth of direct evidence, the overwhelming power of Moses' God has become clear, even to this human representative of Egypt's polytheistic gods, a man who may even believe himself to be divine. And in that surrender, a little bit of humanity from Pharaoh peeks through. "My gods are discredited, my blessings and curses overthrown. In my mourning, in my confusion, in my despair, I need blessing from my worst enemy." There's something perversely, peculiarly human about this, just as true today as over 3,000 years ago. Often in life, we seek blessing not from those who support us and agree with us, but from those who don't. We long for the respect, if not the love, of those who are the hardest to please and least likely to accept us. Sometimes the approval or admiration of our enemies ranks higher in our estimation than the steady praise of our acolytes. As Jews, we know this odd motivation well. How often we struggle with the need for approval from figures who do not give it easily. With that frequent lack of unconditional parental love, the absence of regard from those from whom we most need it, the near desperate desire to be accepted, we all struggle. That is not to say that Pharaoh is just a needy Jewish child or Moses an uncaring father or mother. The Pharaoh of this story is a megalomaniac tyrant, but apparently megalomaniac narcissistic tyrants have emotional needs too. Even in a warped person, the human need for parental, godlike acceptance and approval remains. Perhaps, especially in our time, in a story filled with drama and power, the plaintive request, "Bless me too," adds a human note. We all need to find that blessing. Pharaoh never does. He regrets his weakening and chases after the Israelites to further his own ruin. But perhaps we, who have done so much less wrong than Pharaoh, and who need blessing at least as much, will be able to find it. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Israeli Ambassador Asher Naim, gives us the untold story on the release of the Ethiopian Jews to Israel during Operation Solomon and explains what it was like to create a pipeline to bring Soviet Jews to freedom in the West. Find out when we return on To Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
One of the most influential leaders of the Jewish world, billionaire businessman and philanthropist Edgar Bronfman, the chairman of the Seagram Company and the long-serving president of the World Jewish Congress and the creator of the Bronfman Youth Fellowships, died last week at the age of 84. Bronfman was one of the first mega-rich lay leaders who moved on to philanthropy and changed the landscape of Jewish life around the world. The Montreal-born Bronfman took control of the Seagram Empire from his dad, Samuel Bronfman, who founded the liquor company in 1924. Bronfman expanded its operations, acquiring Tropicana, moving Seagram into the chemicals business by making it DuPont's largest minority shareholder. While still at Seagram's, the family name literally means whiskey man, Edgar Bronfman became president of the World Jewish Congress, remained in that job from 1981 until 2007. During his long tenure, and apart through his efforts, the U.S. Congress increased pressure on the then Soviet Union to loosen immigration restrictions on Jews living there. Bronfman also pressed Congress's efforts to expose the Nazi past of former U.N. Secretary General and later President of Austria, Kurt Waldheim. The World Jewish Congress during that period also joined the efforts to force Swiss banks to make restitution of more than $1 billion to relatives of German death camp victims who deposited funds in Switzerland before World War II. Many Jews around the world are better off today because of Edgar Bronfman's determined, unrelenting fight for justice on their behalf, said the current president of the World Jewish Congress, Ronald Lauder. His name will forever be enshrined in the history books. He not only turned the World Jewish Congress into the preeminent international Jewish organization that it is today, but broadened its base by bringing in new member communities in Eastern Europe and other countries. Bronfman also created a fellowship program for developing leaders among U.S., Canadian, and Israeli high school students and helped strengthen and expand Jewish programming on college campuses through Hillel. In 2002, he provided the funding to launch My Jewish Learning, perhaps the best online site for education, now includes the Jewish parenting site, Kfeller. And Edgar Bronfman and his younger brother Charles were among the first philanthropists to bankroll Birthright, the campaign by Jewish organizations and the Israeli government that provides free 10-day trips for college-age students to explore Judaism in Israel. So far, more than 330,000 young Jewish adults have made trips on Birthright, most from the U.S. This is a contributing factor to the new Pew Research Center's report that shows that more than 40% of Jews under age 30 have gone to Israel. In addition, Bronfman has been a staunch supporter of the Israeli-Palestinian peace process and a very vocal and public backer of liberal politicians in Israel and the U.S. President Bill Clinton awarded Edgar Bronfman the Presidential Medal of Freedom back in 1999. He was the first of his kind, a titan of industry who dedicated himself fully to advocating, advancing, and encouraging the Jewish people, said Dana Rauscher, executive director of the Bronfman Family Foundation. Edgar showed how vision and long-term thinking impact the entire landscape of Jewish life. In other news, the Forward newspaper's annual survey of the top wage earners in the Jewish communal world is out, and it is a little surprising. The study lists compensation packages insofar as they can be ascertained for the top 60 or so salaried leaders of Jewish organizations. And 9 of the top 23 are Jewish Federation executive directors, now often called CEOs around the country. In fact, going a little deeper, 17 of the top 40 wage earners in the Jewish nonprofit world are Federation employees, all of whom earn between $722,000 and $250,000. Apparently, fundraising for Jewish causes for an organization that doesn't provide any direct services can be very lucrative. The top 12 earners at Jewish nonprofits are all over $500,000 a year in salary, and sitting atop the list again is Richard Joel, the head of Yeshiva University, which had a very bad year, by the way, at $855,000 a year. While that's less than a quarter of the average of a Major League Baseball player in 2013, it's still pretty darn good money. Marvin Heyer of the Wiesenthal Center is next at $751,000 a year. Stephen Hoffman at the Cleveland Federation makes $722,000. Rounding out the top five are Frederick Lawrence, the new president of Brandeis, and Abe Foxman, the head of the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, and a past guest of Two Jewish, both at around $700,000 a year. In an era when the truly rich are worth not millions but billions, when entertainers of no talent, like, say, the Kardashians, rake in many millions, and when benchwarmers in professional sports make millions of dollars for doing more or less nothing, it is hard to say what seems like excessive compensation for a nonprofit leader. But clearly, if you want to do well in the Jewish nonprofit world, the clearest path to financial success comes through becoming a federation executive, as you collect money for the good of the Jewish community, of course. Finally, the disclosure last week that American intelligence agents spied on former Israeli prime ministers has given new momentum to the efforts to secure a pardon for convicted U.S. spy Jonathan Pollard. Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu and several leading members of Knesset have called in recent days for Pollard's release, following reports that documents leaked by former defense contractor Edward Snowden showed U.S. intelligence has targeted the email addresses of Ehud Barak and Ehud Olmert, among others. Pollard's case isn't disconnected from the U.S. spying on Israel, Nachman Shai, the co-chair of the Knesset Caucus to Free Pollard, said. It turns out it's part of life, and what he did, too, is a part of life. Knesset Speaker Yuli Edelstein accused the U.S. of hypocrisy for holding Pollard, who as a civilian U.S. Navy analyst spied on the U.S. for Israel, even while it spied on Israeli leaders for, you know, America. Transportation Minister of Israel Yisrael Katz said he wants the Israeli government to demand Pollard's release and insist the U.S. cease its espionage operations in Israel. And Israeli opposition leader Isaac Herzog said Pollard's punishment has long passed the limits of sensibility. We hope that the conditions will be created that will enable us to bring Jonathan Pollard home, Netanyahu said at his weekly cabinet meeting in Israel. This is neither conditional on nor related to recent events, even though we have given our opinion on these developments. When Pollard's crimes first came to light in the mid-1980s, his activities seemed like a major act of betrayal, given the close alliance between Israel and the U.S. But the Snowden revelations show that spying by the United States and Israel was a two-way affair at the time, and probably now, prompting a new round of calls for the release of Jonathan Pollard. Support for freeing Pollard represents a rare point of full consensus in Israeli politics. 100 Knesset members out of 120 signed a letter asking Obama to release Pollard. 80 members signed a similar letter last year. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world.
We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish Ambassador Asher Naim, a longtime member of the Israeli Diplomatic Corps. We spoke earlier about his early life coming to Israel, becoming part of Israel, coming from Tripoli. Ambassador Naim, you had some extraordinarily important diplomatic posts. You were sent to Kenya and Uganda to begin the foundation of Israel's diplomatic outreach to sub-Saharan Africa in the early 60s. You were in Washington, D.C., you served in Philadelphia. I want to talk a little bit about your service as ambassador of Israel to Ethiopia in 1990 to 91, a critical period when the Ethiopian Jews came to Israel in that remarkable operation that galvanized the world. Tell us a little bit about how that happened, some of the stories of that experience.
Okay. I was ambassador Finland.
Finland, right.
And I was dealing with...
Couldn't be much more different. Finland and then
exactly,
Uganda.
Exactly. That's exactly what
Ethiopia.
I wanted. There is definitely I was busy getting the Russian Jews from Leningrad and the Baltic state to take the train
to
in
Helsinki.
6 hours. They will be in Finland, and then they will take to El Al, to Israel. And they told me, listen, if you do that, you can save us a lot of money, because otherwise they have to go to Moscow and all that, and Hungary and
process,
all that.
Right.
So I worked on it, and I succeeded. The minute I succeeded, I received a telephone call, and they said, Asher, we need you in Ethiopia. I said, Ethiopia? What has to do with Ethiopia? No, it's a big crisis, very important. You have to go. So in the foreign service, it's like a military. You know, you get an order and
you go.
Right. So I said, I read about Ethiopia is the lowest income in the world, and Finland is the highest income in the world.
Quite a contrast.
The contrast is terrific. So I had to go, and I went. And I must tell you, the minute I landed, I felt good with the Ethiopians. They are poor, but they are nice people.
Very.
They are not fighting. They are not hitting one another, and they have a dictator who took over from Haile Selassie, the last
Mengistu
emperor.
Mengistu
Haile Mariam.
Right.
And my assignment was to get the Jews out. How is your business? You know, so I went to Mengistu Haile Mariam. He sold his country to the Russians, to the Soviet, not the Russians.
Right, Soviet Union.
Yeah, the Soviet Union. And the Soviet wanted from him to be a communist. So what did he do? He was telling the people there that the religion is opium to the people. They're religious people. How can you tell them? And then they are very poor people. Each has a piece of land. And now he says, not yours anymore.
It belongs to everyone.
Communism. So there's the movement against the regime. And there were two organizations that were really winning, not so much because they are so talented, but because of the cooperation of the people.
Of the people who didn't want what Mariam
was
pushing on them.
The Mengistu to get out.
Right.
So I wanted to visit Gondar.
Kind of the homeland of the Ethiopian Jews.
Right. So when I presented my credential, it is a moment of grace, they call it. In other words, if you have something to ask, you can ask when you present your credential. You have
a diplomatic moment of grace.
Yeah, great.
That's your chance.
Yeah, and I said, I want to visit Gondar. And he all of a sudden became very annoyed. What do you mean you want to visit? We are all falashas. And I looked at him. He said, yes. Do you have 75 million people place in your country? What is he referring to? Queen of Sheba, according to their story,
is the mother of the whole Ethiopian people.
Yeah, and she had a baby from King Solomon. Therefore, they were Jewish.
Right.
And then they were introduced to Christianity. So that makes everybody...
Everybody's a falasha.
A falasha.
Incredible story.
So
somehow you managed to negotiate with Mengistu and with the rebels. And as I recall, there was sort of a moment in the Civil War where there was an opportunity to get everybody out.
Right. It was when my last report about the war was that the rebels are closing in on Addis Ababa.
Right.
And Addis Ababa was crowded with people. And I said, if the war will be switched in the city itself, some of our people will get hurt. So Shamir, who was the prime minister at the time, he said, I don't care how much it costs. What do you do? I want the Jews out. And before this happened, you know, he's prime minister. He can ask anything he wants.
Sure.
So we were negotiating with the Mengistu about how much do we have to pay? You know, I knew that his principal assistant knew about our relations with Romania. We used to pay Romanian Ceausescu $1,000 per head per every Jew that is allowed
to
leave
to
Romania and go to Israel. So we figured out 15,000 Jews, 15,000, 1,000, 15 million.
we can afford it.
We can afford $15 million.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So when we went to him, he said $100 million. I said, how can you get, how do you make the account? He said, I don't care the account. I need $100 million. So we had the bargain and negotiate, and eventually end up with $36 million. I said, okay. My friend went to New York, and the Federation of New York gathered about 45 Jews. And this, my friend told them the whole story, which was secret in this. And he said, we need $35 million. So they said, you will have $35 million in Chase Manhattan Bank tomorrow morning.
Oh my.
You go and finish negotiations and save the Jews. So he called me up. He said, Asher, we got it, so you can go ahead. So I went to them, I said, oh, okay, which was the number of your
Swiss
account?
Bank account, right?
Swiss bank account. So he gave me. And I woke up the Israeli Consul General in New York. I asked him, could you please find out if this is the number, if the number corresponds to the government of Ethiopia?
Right.
He said, Asher, you're calling me at 5 o'clock in the morning? I said, come on, I need it.
Gotta save the Jews.
Yeah. So he went and he told me, no, it is not the government of Ethiopia. So I called up Casa Cabeda. I said, the number you gave me, it's not government of Ethiopia. He said, I'm sorry, I gave you the wrong number. I said, when you have the right number, please
give
call
me. Give me a call and we'll transfer the money. So he was trying to keep the money himself.
He's probably of his, I don't know.
His own private, somebody's private account, not even his.
No.
Somebody was trying to steal the $35 million.
Exactly.
That's a fantastic story. I want to thank Ambassador Asher Naim. I feel like we could talk for hours and it would all be great. Thank you so much for a great visit on 2 Jewish.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm very happy to be here. I think I was very much impressed with the Jewish community here. Go on from strength to strength.
From your mouth to God's ears. When we come back on 2 Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on 2 Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Rabbi Meir Azari, senior rabbi of the largest and most successful Reform synagogue in Israel, the Beit Daniel Center in Tel Aviv, talking about the Reform movement's tremendous resurgence in Israel. Our playout this morning comes from cantor David Dudu Fischer, the great Israeli chazan and musical star. His tune for the new year, a secular one, Shana Tova, have a good new year. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a good secular New Year's. Drive safely, please. And a week, we pray, of peace.
Shana Tova, Shana Tova, Anava. Tavi slicha, gam ahava, tavi pius vegam shalva. Yamim holchim, yamim baim, silchi gam at lachataim, rab icholim. Simchi noflim bechesedot.